rise. The Intermediate Court of Appeals is now reconvened. The Honorable Daniel R. Foley, Lawrence M. Reifert, and Lisa M. Ginoza presiding. Please be seated. Consolidated case number CAAP-10-188 and CAAP-11-19, County of Hawaii, this is UNIDEV LLC. Paul Alston and Claire Black for the appellant, and Laureen L. Martin for the appellant. Argument on the merits.
Mr. Alston, thank you. May it please the court. I understand the argument today is going to be broken into four segments. I intend to use 7 minutes for my opening argument with respect to the defendants and reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal and argument on the county's appeal. The court should reinstate the Lewis Pennons. There are 4 points I want to make very briefly. First, we asserted a claim under the Hawaii Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act, which it is now battle-tested. It has survived a motion for summary judgment brought by the county. That claim, we submit, if we prevail, will lead directly to a transfer of both the fee simple and the leased interest in the property back to WWH and HIHT. And therefore, that claim is one that under Section 634-51 directly affects both possession and title to the property. As the decisions that we cited in Sportschenko, Valvanis, and Kirkaby all reflect, a claim under the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act is in fact one that affects title or possession and does therefore trigger the right to issue notice of pendency of action. In that regard, a HUFTA claim is distinct from and very different than the kinds of squishy equitable claims for constructive trust and so forth, which the Hawaii Supreme Court has repeatedly indicated are not sufficient to support a Lewis Pendens. Rather, as again, Sportschenko, Valvanis, Kirkaby, and the other 5 cases we cited from courts around the country, which rely on the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act, reflect a UFTA claim is sufficient to support a Lewis Pendens, and we would ask you to recognize that the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act is a uniform act adopted in Hawaii, and therefore under Section 1-24, in deciding both the scope of what's available under UFTA and the interplay between UFTA and the pendant statute, you should look for uniformity. And we've cited a number of cases that support our position. The county has really offered none that support its position that an UFTA claim can't sustain a Lewis Pendens. And finally, the cases that the county relies on to support its position are really not in support of its position. The Canales and Rulo cases were ones where there was only a constructive trust claim pleaded. The Lathrop case, where there was a fraudulent transfer claim pleaded, was dismissed as moot. It does not, in fact, support any argument that the court rejected the notion that a claim can't support those pendants. So I'd ask you to reverse, based on our papers, and direct the circuit court to allow those pendants to be reinstated.
Counsel, the two federal cases that you cite, yes, they both refer to Kirkaby, right?
Yes.
Kirkaby reflects the California Lewis Pendens scheme. Does it make any difference that California's Lewis Pendens scheme involves the court taking a look at the merits of the claim?
I think in one respect, that does provide a layer of protection, but the same protection has already been afforded to the county in this case. They filed a motion for dismiss and or the alternative for summary judgment and lost. I don't think that it makes any difference. I think California, our Supreme Court in Sinomiya looked to California law in the Urez case. The Supreme Court in Kirkaby comes along and puts on top of Urez an exception for UFTA claims. I think that that's stands on its face as being as reflecting that there is a under UFTA a remedy that directly reflects title and possession.
If I could understand the proceedings in terms of the summary judgment motion, so you're saying while this appeal was pending, that the motion was filed and further rulings by the circuit court?
No, Your Honor. Actually, if you look at the record, the motion that led to the expungement was a motion to expunge and dismiss or in the alternative.
I see. You're referring to that motion. Okay.
Yes, and the court granted and denied in part. Denied on the merits, granted with respect to the expungement.
Because I understood the record to be that the proceedings below are stayed except for some limited exceptions.
They have been. Okay. That's right. But that was one of the things that happened
immediately after
the case was returned from the federal court. And in fact, it was in that context that there was the very preliminary discussion about whether this case would be arbitrated.
May it please the court. Good morning. Laurie Martin on behalf of the County of Hawaii. A list pendant is limited to actions directly seeking to obtain title or possession of real property. And UNIDEV admits that it is not seeking title or possession of the property for itself. Instead, UNIDEV seeks to have the property returned to other entities simply to secure a potential judgment which it may in the future obtain. However, this court and the Hawaii Supreme Court has repeatedly held that a lese pendens is not to be used to secure a money judgment, and for good reason. A lese pendens places a cloud on property which makes it unmarketable and unsuitable as security for a loan. A lese pendens in this case would jeopardize the county's affordable housing project. The circuit court correctly expunged the lese pendens in this matter, and this court should affirm that decision. However, the circuit court erred when it ordered all claims by and against the county into arbitration. It is a fundamental principle that there must be a binding agreement which exists between the parties.
Counsel, before we get to that argument, if you don't mind, what about Mr. Alston's argument that this is different from those other Hawaii cases you referred to because this involves a HUFTA claim?
I don't think it's different at all. If anything, it's less strong. Basically, what UNIDEV in this case was they knew the county was going to transfer the property and the county provided them notice. And then they submit these false invoices after that and they try and squeak in this uniform fraudulent transfer act and use that as this automatic lese pendens in order to stop the project.
What about his reference to the HUFTA claim having survived summary judgment already? Does that provide some context or additional cover for you?
I don't believe so. Obviously, I disagree with the court's ruling on that matter, but I can understand that it was early in the litigation. It required a motion to dismiss and or a motion for summary judgment, and the court was aware that the county's concern was this lese pendens.
You know, the argument that UNIDEV makes, just real quickly, is essentially based on California case law that has come out subsequent to Utsunomiya. And in a very succinct manner, how do you address, I mean, in Utsunomiya, the Hawaii Supreme Court followed California law, and the argument on the other side is that that's what this court should do as well.
Right. I think that's a very simplistic way of looking at the law. The law has clearly changed over time in California. There's so many options for a party that has a lese pendens filed against their properties. They have three different ways to expunge it. In Hawaii, that's just that one statute, and the Hawaii Supreme Court has indicated that they're really concerned about the potential abuse of that. So I don't think you can really compare the decisions out of California with the ones from Hawaii, even though they did find some reason and some basis that they thought was convincing to follow from California. Clearly, it would be a mistake to just adopt all of California's law. It's fundamental that there must be a binding contract which exists between the parties, and the undisputed facts establish that the county is not a party to the DSA or the ABSA. For over a year after this case was filed, UNIDEV consistently and repeatedly argued the county was not a party to the DSA or the ABSA. In its answer, which was filed in March 2010, UNIDEV stated, defendants admit UNIDEV entered into the amended DSA with WWH. The county was not a named party or signatory to the amended DSA. Their counterclaim, which was filed on the same date, WWH was set up to take over from the county the performance of certain contracts pertaining to the project, including the DSA. WWH assumed from the county certain contracts pertaining to the project, including the DSA. UNIDEV also stated, in February 2008, UNIDEV and WWH executed an amended restated development services agreement. There's no mention of the county entering into that. UNIDEV also stated, in July 2006, the county assigned its rights under the DSA to WWH, and WWH assumed the county's obligations thereunder. Their counterclaim goes on to state, UNIDEV and WWH entered into the ADSA, yet county officials and employees were extensively involved in the negotiation, even though the county was not a party to the DSA.
And an arbitration provision, the requirements under an arbitration provision carry forward against a party even after the contract has been assigned?
I think it would depend upon the assignment itself. If there was some obligation on the original assignor to comply with it, perhaps. In this case, the assignment is very clear that all of the obligations, all of the rights are being transferred. UNIDEV was well aware of that from the DSA, which it signed and agreed to. I mean, this was all UNIDEV's idea to do. So they were well aware of the assignment. And there's no issue that UNIDEV consented to that assignment that transferred all rights and obligations. So, for example, Jeffrey Minter signed a declaration which was filed in federal court in October 2009. He was the executive vice president of UNIDEV. And he states, UNIDEV also consented to the assignment and assumption agreement between the county and WWH. In addition, in response to admissions, UNIDEV admitted that it consented to the assignment. It stated, defendants admit that UNIDEV consented to the assignment of the development services agreement from the County of Hawaii to WWH. So if they had an objection, if they thought that the county should remain bound in any way, including the arbitration agreement, they should have objected, or there should have been some carve out within the assignment in the assumption agreement, which there is not. So
nothing
now,
specific with regards to the arbitration requirement in the original DSA.
No. The assignment,
any of the declarations or any of the communications that are in the record.
It was to the consent to the assignment itself, not specifically to the arbitration. And the point is that that UNIDEV, they come in, they answer, they file these counterclaims. Their entire counterclaim is based upon the county not being a party to either the DSA or the ADSA, like the interference with contractual relations. That's the basis of their claim. This is what they pled. They pled this for a year and then came in after and said, wait a minute, no, the county's bound by that. They have to arbitrate. Yet they've never amended those claims at all. Those are still good claims. Those are judicial admissions.
So is your legal argument here waiver, or are you arguing something else?
It's part of it is waiver. Part of it is that we are not a party to the DSA and the ADSA. That those are the underlying facts. And I understand that counsel has made some arguments and disputes whether the county is a party to it or not. But the underlying facts are not in dispute. The underlying facts say the county of Hawaii signed this contract with the consent of UNIDEV. The underlying facts show that the ADSA is between UNIDEV and WWH. You know,
so
despite those arguments.
Sorry, with regards to the declarations that were submitted in the circuit court, which were, I believe, declarations both by UNIDEV, the county does not dispute them, the facts or the allegations in those declarations, the assertions in those declarations. When you say, and this is the reason I asked, when you say that the underlying facts are not in dispute and you've referenced Mr. Minter's declaration, then given our standard of review, the county is saying that there is no facts relevant to whether the arbitration exists, the arbitration agreement exists or not between the county and UNIDEV?
I think the facts as I put forward are clear, that those are undisputed. We're not, we've never disputed that the county signed the DSA. it's very clear we're not a party to the ADSA. We don't dispute the assignment. UNIDEV doesn't dispute the assignment. They don't dispute that they consented to the assignment. Those facts are all undisputed. And UNIDEV's the one that bears the burden of proving. Did I come across that? UNIDEV bears the burden of proving the existence of a binding contract which requires arbitration. However, rather than producing facts that support it, they have for over a year stated the opposite, that the county's not a party to that agreement. Even if they could establish that the county was a party, they clearly waived their right to compel arbitration. And it's difficult to imagine a clearer case of waiver. Rarely would you have the council stating to a circuit court judge that that's what they decided to do.
Can you waive without it being in writing?
I don't see why that would be a statute of frauds issue.
There's anti-waiver provisions in the agreements, right?
That's true, but there's case law saying that you can't contract away your legal obligations.
Is the waiver issue for the court or for the arbitrator?
I think it's clearly for the court. There's the majority position is that it's for the court. In addition, this court, as well as the Hawaii Supreme Court, has addressed the waiver issue, so it seems like it's appropriate for the court to address.
Under the revised arbitration statute?
I haven't looked at that issue specifically under the new statutes, but I believe that it's appropriate for the appellate court to address that issue. It seems quite unfair to compel us into arbitration when you probably shouldn't be there anyway without the court deciding that.
Ms. Martin, could you recount, I just want to make sure I understand the procedural history in terms of when the case went to the federal court. It was removed initially, right, by UNIDEV. What were the proceedings there specifically prior to the remand back to state court?
UNIDEV removed it. The county filed a motion to remand. During the interim, UNIDEV filed a motion to dismiss. Prior to I think the court moved the motion to dismiss, didn't want to rule on that until it had decided if it had jurisdiction and ultimately remanded.
What was the basis for the motion to dismiss?
I believe the primary argument was that fraud wasn't pled with particularity. UNIDEV and its counsel made a deliberate and strategic decision to forego arbitration, preferring instead to litigate in the courts. They immediately removed this case to federal court, hoping for a quick and favorable ruling. However, that did not happen. When it was remanded, it went back to state court where it belonged, and UNIDEV litigated there for a while and apparently became dissatisfied with those rulings. And now they're trying for their third forum, and they're asking to go to arbitration.
If there were a written agreement that would bind the county to arbitrate, when is the litigant required to make the motion to compel?
I think that they should at least early on maybe plead it in the answer that there's an issue, even if they're not going to move to compel. I know I read a case, I believe in Hawaii, that talked about the party being on notice because it was in the answer. Even though the person didn't move immediately to compel, it was out there. So
it's not an affirmative defense, though, is it?
It is, according to the case law, it's an affirmative defense.
So you would say if it's not in the answer, it's waived?
Yes, unless they come in and move to amend the answer. This is an issue in this case because their answer and their counterclaim still state that the county of Hawaii is not a party to the DSA or the ADSA, yet they're moving to compel arbitration under those agreements against us. If they came in and amended, perhaps you could say, well, that was an oversight, but it clearly wasn't given all of these facts.
The statement by Mr. Fritz with regards to the waiver issue, what was the context of that statement? What was that hearing was with regards to the motion to expunge, I believe.
I believe it was. It was on the motion to dismiss, expunge, and the alternative for motion for summary judgment. I believe the court brought up the issue from looking at the document, the agreement, and asked whether that was required.
Looking at the DSA and the ADSA.
Yes, exactly. And that was Mr. Fritz's response. And from my perspective, we all know that perhaps you may say something that you didn't mean. Perhaps you're caught off guard. But this has been a pattern of behavior. It's in their answer. It's in their counterclaim. They're relying on those allegations. This is a top firm in Honolulu. I think we can all agree. They didn't do anything by mistake. This was all intentional. They went to federal court. They're back in state court. They're unhappy. Now we're going into arbitration.
Is there any reason why they would not be able to file the Liz Pendens while in an arbitration proceeding as opposed to a court proceeding?
I don't think they could. I believe the court had ruled on that issue when UNIDEF had filed for a motion to stay, and the court had ruled that it's within the court's jurisdiction to decide that issue.
I guess what I mean is, if they had chosen to go to raise their right to arbitrate and had sought to go that route as opposed to the litigation route while in arbitration, would there be something to preclude UNIDEF from filing a Liz Pendens, irregardless of the HFTA issues, but technically, under the statute, as far as you know?
Under the statute, I don't think so. I'm putting aside the arguments I had made to the court saying that I thought that the court didn't have jurisdiction, but no, I don't think so. The agreement does provide that they're not to file an injunction or other legal remedy, but aside from that, no. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Austin.
Thank you, Aaron. The county presents two and perhaps three issues for this court to decide. The first is whether there is, in fact, an agreement to arbitrate. Although Ms. Martin unequivocally says they acknowledge that the county was not a party to the DSA, there is, in fact, no such acknowledgement. No one can really seriously contest that the county was a party to the DSA. The question is whether there were subsequent agreements that somehow relieved the county of all of its responsibilities under the DSA by working a novation and somehow eliminating its responsibilities. There is no novation. There was no document that released the county from its obligations, either substantive or procedural, with respect to its obligation to arbitrate. Martin wants to stand the party's responsibilities with respect to this documentation on its head. The Hornbook law and the basic rule is that an assignment and an assumption agreement do not eliminate the obligations of the original obligor under the contract. That's in section 318 of the Restatement of Contracts. And the rule is, under the restatement and under all the cases that follow it, that if an obligor under a contract wants to get away from its continuing responsibilities, then the parties have to come to an agreement that clearly provides for that sort of release and that sort of protection against future responsibilities. There is nothing in this record that reflects that was done. In fact, if you look at the DSA, it has a broad indemnity provision that obligates the county to indemnify UNIDEV and its employees under certain circumstances. If you look at the assignment and assumption agreement, which is in the record, I believe, page 115, the county agrees to indemnify, defend, and hold WWH harmless with respect to things that happened under the contract.
Isn't that only up to the point that of the assignment, though, or is it? Isn't there language like that?
The language is ambiguous, and I think, in fact, it is broader than that. But because what it says is, Asinor shall defend and hold Asinie, its successors, assigns, employees, etc., harmless from any claim suffered or incurred as a result of any act or omission of Asinor. Or in connection with any contract prior to the date hereof. So you have two clauses. The modifier prior to the date hereof appears to relate only to in connection with any contract. And so I submit that in fact the indemnity is broader than just acts that predated the date of the assignment. And so if you find the county offers nothing to justify varying from the general rule that an assignor remains on the hook with respect to the performance of the contract. You don't, in none of the documents will you find any awareness of the county asking or the UNIDEV giving a release to the county with respect to its liabilities. As to the novation question, I submit that that's something that really the arbitrator should decide. It really amounts to a defense to liability, and this court should not be delving into the merits of claims, defenses, and arguments. Leave that to the arbitrator to decide. The second issue raised by the county's appeal is whether this case arises out of or involves claims that are within the scope of the arbitration agreement. We know that what the arbitration agreement says is that it covers and that the parties shall arbitrate disputes, quote, arising under the DSA and then the ADSA. The county argues for a very cramped reading of that phrase, arising under, but that argument fails for two reasons. First, in the Rainbow Chevrolet case, the Supreme Court dealt with a similar arbitration clause. It was, in that case, it also consigned to arbitration claims arising under the parties' agreements. And the Supreme Court adopted what I'll call the birth, life, and death test. That is, if the claim relates in any way to the birth, the life, or the death of the contract, it goes into arbitration. And quite broadly read the arising under language as being the same as related to and arising out of the contract. And so if you follow Rainbow Chevrolet, you have to give that case that phrase a broad reading. The county relies on the Ninth Circuit's stingy reading of the phrase arising under. The problem with it that is there, as in so many things, the Ninth Circuit is really an outlier. Because if you look at the case law from the Third Circuit, the Fourth Circuit, the Sixth Circuit, the Seventh Circuit, and the Eleventh Circuit, all of those cases give the phrase arising under a broad reading, which is consistent with the public policy to encourage arbitration. And so I would submit that the proper course for you is to give it the broad reading that Rainbow Chevrolet and the wealth of federal circuit court cases indicate is appropriate. If you do that, you then will be consigning to arbitration our claims that arise out of breach of contract and our claim for fraudulent transfer. We did plead in the alternative, a point which obviously the rules allow, but the county makes a lot of. We pleaded a quantum merit claim and a tortious interference claim. I submit that those are sufficiently intertwined with the contractual relationship that they too arise under the birth, life, and death of the agreement. But if in fact you find that some of those claims or one or another of those claims is beyond what the parties agreed to arbitrate, then the proper course is simply to stay them. We'll go arbitrate, decide what can be decided. That will be given collateral estoppel and res judicata effect, and then we'll pick up the pieces later if there's anything left to pick up. But it's clearly not the case that we have admitted the county was not responsible under the DSA. They obviously signed it. We think they're bound by it on an ongoing basis as long as the controversy exists. And the case law is quite clear that if an arbitration provision does not by its terms expire when the contract ends, then the obligation to arbitrate continues. We're in exactly that situation.
Mr. Olson, very quickly, what is the situation vis-a-vis the claims against WWH?
The claims against WWH are going to arbitration, and that leads me back to, if I could, talk about Mr. Fritz's statement on May 24th. That did come up in the context of the motion to expunge. Judge Strantz rightly said, what about mediation? Why isn't anybody moving to compel mediation? And that segued into a discussion of arbitration. At that point, our client was inclined to proceed with litigation. But there is a game changer, because shortly after that, in June, just two weeks later or so, WWH moves for arbitration and says, let's go, we have to go arbitrate everything. And at that point, UNIDEV is faced with the prospect of a multi-front war, if you will, having to arbitrate some claims that arise out of the DSA and ADSA, and having to litigate others, and our client decides, basically 5 months into the process of this case in the state court, that we should arbitrate everything. It's more efficient.
Could you address the issue of waiver?
Yes, I will, Your Honor. First, I think under the RUAA Section 6, the issue of waiver is one to be decided by the arbitrator, not by this court. If you look at the Supreme Court's decision in Howsam versus Dean Witter, that case reflects the fact that Section 6 of the RUAA, which is part of Hawaii law, distinguishes between substantive arbitrability and procedural arbitrability, and says that issues of procedural arbitrability should be decided by the arbitrator. What are those? Those are latches, estoppel, and other doctrines that are sisters of waiver, and says that if those issues need to be decided by the arbitrator, then waiver as well needs to be decided by the arbitrator. If, however, you decide to get to that question, then there is clearly no waiver here. It is true that at the time, early in the case, there was a decision made, but that decision was changed, again, because of the changed circumstances precipitated by WWH's petition to compel arbitration.
What are the limitations on a party's ability to reverse field on it if there was a waiver?
Well, two things. It, from the standpoint of judicial estoppel, the predicate for judicial estoppel is some advantage gained and some reliance by the court on a statement made. Here there was none of that. We lost the list pendants, and we move forward. We're still litigating that issue, obviously, but there was nothing that supports a claim of judicial estoppel in reversing course. The second thing is, Your Honor, I think that if you look at all the cases that the Supreme Court has decided, from Shamote through Rainbow Chevrolet to Swinnerton, all of those cases, what you have to find is something that is conduct which is absolutely inconsistent with the idea of being able to arbitrate. I submit that a passing reference to arbitration, in a motion on something else at the very beginning of a case does not preclude reversing course on that issue and saying, yes, it, we now see the wisdom of arbitrating.
Well, to be fair to Ms. Martin, that isn't the only basis for her waiver claim, Mr. Fritz's comment.
Right.
So it's more than that.
Right. I know, to be sure. But if you look at what she talks about and you compare them to the facts in the other cases, there is clearly not enough here to affect a waiver. In Shimote, the one case where the Supreme Court has found a waiver, it was 6 years of litigation with a motion coming on the eve of trial. We are at the beginning of this case. And if you look at Chevrolet, it was more than a year. If you look at Swinnerton, it was more than a year. If you look at all those cases where the court has said there was no waiver, there was more done, more time passed, and exactly the kind of thing that Ms. Martin complains about here. There was some discovery.
Two questions.
Yes.
What was the basis for the motion to dismiss in federal court, number one? And number two, do you believe that you would have been able to file a list pendants if you had gone the arbitration route from the beginning?
I do. The motion to dismiss in federal court was, as Ms. Martin says, based on 9B, pleading defects.
Okay.
And the federal court never got there because it was concerned, rightly, about whether it had jurisdiction in the first instance.
So the case was remanded back, and that motion was never refiled in circuit court. Okay. And then on the arbitration issue, on the list, filing a list pendants?
Filing a list pendants. Under the RUAA, the court has authority to allow provisional remedies. And so I believe that from the standpoint of filing a list pendants or seeking a preliminary injunction or any other sort of provisional remedy that would sort of preserve the status quo, it is appropriate to ask the court to do that. question comes under, you know, whether under the statute you can ask for a list pendants or file a notice of pendency of action when there's no lawsuit.
Obviously, the reason I ask that is UNIDEV files the list pendants seeking, right after filing its counterclaim.
Correct.
Question is whether it was utilizing the court's jurisdiction in furtherance of the list pendants, which of course would potentially affect the waiver issue.
Right.
So how would you address that?
Yeah, I submit that it would not affect the waiver, again, because of the express statutory authority under the RUA, under Chapter 658A, for provisional remedies that allow a court, even in the face of arbitration, to, again, issue placeholding remedies or status quo maintaining remedies. And I submit that whether a party comes in and asks for a preliminary injunction, or whether they say issue a list pendants and permit the filing of a list pendants, that's simply a status quo maintenance remedy.
So your position is that the reason why you changed positions with regards to arbitration was because WWH sought to compel arbitration 2 months after Mr. Fritz made his statement.
I think it is fair to say that those decisions, the decision was greatly influenced by the fact that WWH called for arbitration. Because if you look at Mr. Fritz's statement on May 24th in the transcript, he says, at this point, the parties have decided not to proceed with arbitration. Well, obviously that was not, as it turned out, an accurate statement with respect to the newly joined party, WWH. And when we were faced with the prospect of a two-front war, it made sense to change position. And I submit that in doing so, very promptly after the case was filed, or not filed, the case began its life in circuit court, that there was no prejudice, there was nothing done by us before that point that the Supreme Court would recognize, or this court should recognize, as being irretrievably and irrevocably inconsistent with the desire to arbitrate.
Yeah, under Shimote and I think Rainbow Chevrolet, the cases where waiver was addressed, so there is no reference to prejudice or an analysis of prejudice. I mean, shouldn't that still be the same analysis under the revised Arbitration Act?
I submit that you're right. None of those cases refer specifically to prejudice. But they do refer to the parties doing something that is irrevocably inconsistent with wanting to arbitrate. And I submit that the flip side of doing something irrevocable is, in fact, some prejudice to the other side. Something we've done something, we've proceeded so far down the road that it's unfair to turn back. Otherwise, if it's only discovery, then the Swinnerton case says that's not enough. And in fact, if you look at the discovery that was done, the record reflects there were efforts to get documents, there was preliminary efforts to get depositions. I can tell you that all of that is being used and continuing under the auspices of the arbitrator. It's not as if something was done that was impossible to do under the arbitration, unnecessary to do under the arbitration. Preliminary. Ordinary type of document and fact gathering is directly relevant to the arbitration. So I would submit that the claims that there was a waiver are just overblown. It's clear that there were things done, and it's clear that there was one statement made, but none of that amounts to an irrevocable commitment to litigation as opposed to arbitration. The court asked, and Ms. Morton commented on the fact that arbitration was not reflected in the answer to the demand for arbitration of the right to arbitration.
What you're also saying primarily whether or not there's a waiver is not for this court, for the arbitrator.
That's the threshold position. That's right. I'm just addressing this in the off chance that you go there. And if you go there, I mean, I think from the standpoint of what was in the pleadings or not in the pleadings, the question to ask is, if we had asked to amend, if indeed we needed to amend, and if indeed it's an affirmative defense, would we, barely 5 months into the life of the case in the circuit court, have been permitted to amend? The answer is unquestionably yes. We could have said, all right, we're going to amend the pleading to refer to arbitration. But more importantly, perhaps, when we raised the issue of arbitration, the county didn't respond and said it's an affirmative defense. It's not in your answer. You can't raise this. We then proceeded to litigate the issue. And so, having gone down that path, I think the case law is clear that you don't stand form over substance. You look at what the parties did and decide on that. I have no further argument unless you have any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you.
Smart.
Thank you. Unidev argues that it's Hornbook law that the assignment and assumption does not release the obligee unless the parties agreed. Unidev consented to the assignment and assumption agreement. That's their release of their obligation. They signed the DSA knowing that WWH would assume all of those duties. They stated under oath they consented to it. They've never taken an opposite position as far as facts. They argue differently. There's no underlying facts to support that. They're looking for a written agreement that says, if we hereby discharge county, it's not required. Unidev also argues that the indemnification agreement somehow undoes the effect of the assignment, that somehow the county agreed to indemnify WWH and so it remained bound by the DSA. That would undermine the very purpose of the assignment. It makes no sense. And as Justice Ginoso mentioned, the language in there applies to contracts prior to WWH assuming that role, which makes sense. Unidev also argues that there's numerous cases out there other than the Ninth Circuit that disagree with the Ninth Circuit, that arising out of is very broad. However, Unidev has blurred the distinction between those cases, and a lot of those cases refer to arising out of or related to, and the courts have decided that additional language is very significant. The or related to is very significant. That is not contained in our arbitration agreement.
Ms. Martin, kind of the overall sort of structure of this deal, the agreements, the multiple agreements, county passing, assigning the DSA over to a nonprofit to be created later on, et cetera. Is there an explanation for in the record that exists in the record for the agreements themselves don't contain a lot of the explanation for the overall idea. And clearly, the county continued to be very involved even after the assignment. I mean, you don't dispute that.
No, we don't dispute that at all. The county's the one who wanted the project. It was an affordable housing project for the
county. Had to finance the project.
Exactly. Although that wasn't the original promise, but the county remained involved, and certainly when it committed $40 million, it wasn't going to just give the $40 million and not pay attention to what was happening. That would be violating the
public. Going to this argument about, you know, the assignment goes over to WWH and therefore the county sort of has washed its hands of the obligations under the DSA, and yet it has the ability to be involved in all of the intricacies of the project. How do you explain that?
There's several other agreements, and that is part of the record. There's a development finance agreement, there's tri-party agreements, which give the county additional rights as it was putting in more and more funds, rights such as attending the meetings, that kind of thing. That does not change the fundamental relationship between Unidev and WWH. This was a relationship that Unidev had sought the county to do. They requested and they told the county that this would protect the county, that this was the way to go, try and protect the county from future obligations, that sort of thing. And the county believed them and did that. So to think that the county is just going to hand over this public housing project and just kind of step away and not have any conditions upon it is not realistic.
The arbitration agreements are only included in the BSA and the ADSA, the amended and restated.
That's correct.
So all of these other agreements that are out there, were they between? Are they in the record? First of all, I mean, I know the financing statement is, and the assignment and so forth. But in terms of the arbitration, the question of arbitrability, it all comes down to whether the parties' obligations continue under the BSA and the ADSA. Is that a fair statement?
I think so. That is the only arbitration agreement is within those two agreements. All of those agreements were attached to the county's opposition to UNIDEP's motion to compel. There is one of those documents that refer, I know UNIDEP has been arguing that the county is bound by the ADSA because WWH was an agent, and that's explicitly spelled out in one of the agreements that WWH is not an agent of the county. So that, in that sense, it could be relevant.
Why doesn't the county want to participate in the arbitration?
We believe that a fair result will be with the jury trial. And honestly, in this particular case, although I was hopeful that we would get an arbitrator that could be acceptable to the county, this particular arbitrator was handpicked by UNIDEP.
But when this whole process began with the DSA, the county was more than happy to agree to arbitration.
But there was a clear understanding that the county was not going to remain a party to the DSA. There was a clear understanding that this contract is going to be assigned to a new entity and the county will not be a party to it.
So you agreed to arbitrate because you knew you wouldn't be arbitrated?
I believe that that's true. I do, because that agreement was not going to be the county's agreement. The day it was signed, it was agreed within that language that it was going to be assigned and the county would not be a party to it.
What would be the effect if we agreed with you that there was that this should proceed through litigation vis-a-vis the county and not through arbitration? Mr. Olson says that the arbitration against WWH is going to proceed. I mean, doesn't that create a challenging situation for the parties? I imagine that witnesses for all of the parties would be relevant in both proceedings.
I agree. And early on, the parties had discussed having whatever discovery was conducted in the arbitration be applicable to the litigation. And I think that probably would be the case.
What are the claims specifically against WWH that would go forward in arbitration?
Breach of contract. I believe that might be a fraudulent conveyance claim as well.
All contained in the counterclaim, in UNIDEP's counterclaim.
Exactly. Okay. UNIDEP states that their fraudulent transfer claim, their tortious interference claim, their unjust enrichment claim, those are inconsistent theories with what they're arguing now. And they're more than just inconsistent legal theories. They're really inconsistent facts. They're completely opposite facts. And one, you're saying the county is bound by this agreement and they're liable for a breach of contract. They have to go in. And on the other side, they're saying they're not bound by it and they interfered with it. It's not just inconsistent legal theories. It's completely opposite facts, and they're unsupported. Their own client has said that the party to the agreement is WWH. I know UNIDEP has indicated that they had a change of heart once they realized WWH was going to insist on enforcing the agreement, the arbitration provision, and that they're concerned about having this war on multiple fronts. However, that's really not a concern, because the court has entered a stay for the litigation. We're going to wait until the arbitration is done. That may have some effect, residual effect on the litigation. They're not going to be forced to arbitrate and litigate in court at the same time. That's not going to happen.
Wouldn't you rather have it all done in one arbitration and do the arbitration and then have to do court after?
Definitely not. I definitely want to.
I mean, from UNIDEP's perspective, wouldn't it be best to have it all done at one time? Everybody at the table?
The reality is that particular claim could possibly resolve a lot, if not all of the things. So it could be, in effect, narrowing it and making it more efficient.
But the stay is in place only because the trial court put everything into ADR, right? I mean, what you're suggesting is, I mean, if in fact there were a split in terms of county claims go to litigation, WWH cases go to arbitration, that's something the circuit court has not considered.
I'm not sure that that's accurate because when the court actually entered those orders, I believe at the same time, or about the same time, and so because the claims against WWH are part of the underlying claims, and the stay entered, I think it probably would apply to all of the other claims, the court action, is my understanding of it.
Well, my point is that wasn't the circumstance that the circuit court was faced with when she entered the stay. In other words, when she entered the stay, she understood everything was going to arbitration.
Except it was clear that the claims by HIHT were not subject to arbitration.
Has anything proceeded?
No, again, HIHT has been cooperating in discovery, trying to work together with the parties as to that level, but they did not agree to arbitration.
But HIHT was simply sort of the pass-through in terms of the fee interest and then the lease, right?
Exactly. I know there was some argument regarding judicial estoppel and that there's been no reliance. And I take a little bit of offense to that, considering that the answer and the counterclaim specifically say over and over how the county's not a party to the DSA and the ADSA. And now here we are today, say with completely different arguments, the county's bound by both of those agreements. There's been no amendment. And yet I'm expected to prepare either for arbitration or trial. And I still don't know. What are they going to argue? I think I've relied on that for a year, year and a half before. And now I realize there's an issue with that. And now I'm not sure how I'm supposed to hammer that down, considering I've got a declaration from the executive vice president saying certain things, which suddenly they're stepping away from. I have admissions saying the opposite to what they're arguing here today. Also, regarding the cases that talk about, I know UNIDEP was arguing that none of the cases found a one-year delay was sufficient for a waiver. And that may be true. However, none of those cases had somebody stating to a circuit court judge that they intentionally waived it, intentionally gave up that right to compel arbitration, and then later decided, well, maybe that wasn't a good idea. None of those cases state that they had filed an extensive pleading stating over and over that the arbitration agreement did not apply. None of those cases stated that. That's what we have here. I just want to raise one issue regarding if you get to the point, if you find that the county is bound by the fine agreement, and you start to decide what claims are going to go into arbitration. UNIDEV's counterclaim, all of it relies upon the county not being a party to the DSA or ADSA. It would be absurd to argue that the claims which rely upon the non-existence of an agreement are bound to arbitrate under that very agreement that they deny the existence. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Court will take the matter under advisement.
Thank you.